Hi, it's Aaron from Gangland Wire. When Gary's not here, I break open the beef jerky, but not just any jerky. I break open the Jurassic Jerky. That's right. Go on over to JurassicJerkyLLC.com and put in your order for some tasty snack meat treats. If you love beef jerky, then you've got to get the carnivore candy from Jurassic Jerky. Put in the promo code GANG10 and you'll get 10% off the entire purchase order. There's my order coming in now.
Gangland Wire is probably the best podcast going at the moment. Gary and Aaron do a fantastic job, and with their range of guests that they bring in, people that have solved the crimes, or even people that have committed the crimes, it really adds some insight into the fantastic true crime stories that they pick on the podcast. If you're new to Gangland Wire, I really would recommend listening to the 7-part interview with Martin McNally. It is some of the best true crime journalism I think I've listened to.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced 4 documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, hello, all you wiretappers out there. We're here in the beautiful Ice House in Midtown Kansas City. I realize I start it like that every time, but kind of gets me in the mood here. Welcome you to our table. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, tonight, folks, we have an interview of a very well-known Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Anthony Tony DeStefano. He recently wrote a book about the Lufthansa heist, covered it from the Vinny Acero. If you follow this mob news at all, a guy named Vinny Acero was kind of the mob boss over this crew and maybe got a little piece of that action. Maybe he got it all. They recently tried him. He got found not guilty. Tony, it's good to have you here tonight. How's it going there in New York City?
Thank you.
So you're doing you just did a book signing.
The cops in the background?
That's true. I did a book signing for the big heist in Bryant Park in New York City. And it went well. And a lot of people are still interested in the mob story. And as you can tell, New York is a very busy place.
Yeah, we can hear the siren in the background.
Sirens and stuff in the background.
Yeah, just talk into your phone. Yeah.
But it went very well. It went very well.
So you've worked, I looked up a little bit about you. You've covered organized crime for 30 years, basically all your entire career, I would guess, covering organized crime. And you've been...
Yeah, on and off for about 30 years, since about 76, 77. So, you know, I've done other things too. Covered Bernie Madoff, you know, covered some major trials of other characters. And, you know, so it's somewhat mixed bag, but mainly organized crime.
Now, I see you've written several books, and they've been all on organized crime. The Last Godfather, Joseph Masino, and The Fall of the Bonanno Crime Family. It's available right now. You also wrote Mob Killer, The Bloody Rampage, Charlie Carneglia, Mafia Hitman. Did I say that right, Carneglia?
You're right.
And
you did. You got it right.
Vinny Gorgeous, The Ugly Rise and Fall. Vinny Gorgeous, I like your title. Vinny Gorgeous, The Ugly Rise and Fall of a New York Mobster. You've All covered right. a little human trafficking, the war on human trafficking. I'd like to, I need to do a show on human trafficking. That's pretty, I hate to say this like this, but it's a hot topic right now. That's pretty important, and there's a lot of interest in that right now, especially even out here in the country in these truck stops and the suburban Asian massage parlors and those things like that. So it's a pretty hot topic.
Yeah, it's a continuing issue.
Yeah, it is. I see you covered the mafia cops. Is that the two cops in New York City that were actually working for the mob?
Yeah, that's Louis Eppolito and Stephen Caracappa.
Yeah, boy.
They both were convicted here. Yeah, they were working for the mob.
They were a piece of work.
Very simple.
I read that book about them since I was I worked in the intelligence unit myself here. In,
yeah, there's a couple of books about them.
And one of them was actually assigned
there were a couple of books. And,
I noticed one of them was actually assigned to the intelligence unit, just like I was assigned to the intelligence unit here in Kansas City. And, you know, Las Vegas had a guy named Joe Blasco that was assigned to the intelligence unit for a period of time, and he was feeding information to Tony Splotter all the time. And these guys here, they were actually going out and doing hits for him. It was amazing. Besides tipping them off,
I know it's amazing. It's amazing, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, it's like. With a major penetration of law enforcement.
Really?
And in a city like New York, and they were out there doing hits for the mob. Incredible.
It is incredible.
Well, it wasn't the first time that's ever happened.
No, it's not. It's not, but I think it was the most egregious because of the number of bodies that piled up as a result of it.
Yeah.
And even some innocent people were killed.
Right. That was the one, like, they had the wrong license number and they ended up killing the wrong guy, or they gave a tip to somebody, you end up killing
the fellow Nicholas Guido. They had the wrong Nicholas Guido, and they wound up killing some young guy who had no connection to anything. It's a tragic story. Christmas Day, in fact.
Well,
Christmas Day.
It's amazing. So let's talk about the Lufthansa heist. Now, tell me, where did Vinny Acero fit into this? We've all seen the movie, or a lot of people have seen the movie. That's kind of my knowledge of it from Henry Hill's view and Nicholas Pileggi's. And I tell you what, I read that book, and that was one of the better depictions of that mid-level or lower-level crews of people who are not made guys but then work for a made guy. That's something that people don't really think about And Vinny Acero, was he like kind of their controller?
Oh, Vinny Acero, if you saw the movie Goodfellas, there was a scene where a young kid was shot in a nightclub by the Joe Pesci character.
Yes.
Shot in the foot, I think it was.
Right.
His name was Spider.
Right.
And he was helped away by somebody.
Yeah.
Supposedly, that was Vinny Acero who helped him away. Now, Vinny Acero was a low-level, at the time, a low-level Bonanno crime family associate. Who, you know, was hanging around Jimmy Burke's, you know, Robert's Lounge in Queens.
Yeah.
And in the film Goodfellas, Vinny Acero, apart from that one reference, really doesn't show up in the story. What happened was that in the book Wise Guy, for which the film is based on.
Right.
Vinny Acero was a sort of peripheral character around the club. Around the Burke's club. And then he became a member of the Bonanno crime family and supposedly had a tie into the airport. But that's as far as it went. Subsequent, you know, evidence developed that Acero was allegedly involved in the Lufthansa heist. By that, I mean the planning and execution. Well, we didn't see that in any of the stories and books that have been written about until now. That's because some of the stuff Henry Hill, the informant, told the feds really wasn't disclosed until I got my hands on it. And that, as a result of various machinations and various informants, they indicted Acero in 2014 for participation in the Lufthansa heist, as well as other crimes. And as the book makes clear, we all thought Acero was going to be convicted when, in fact, he was acquitted in 2015. Quite a shock. Almost miraculous. But, you know, that's the way the ball bounces in law enforcement. You can never tell with a jury. So that, in a nutshell, is Acero's connection.
Yeah.
He allegedly got his hands on some of the loot. He allegedly stashed some of the money and spent it. But, you know, in the end of the day, he can point to a piece of paper saying, well, I was acquitted. So what does that leave you with?
So
it leaves you with some good stories.
If he was a mob guy, he, of course, kind of held, he was a little more powerful in the hierarchy, shall we say, than Jimmy the Gent Burke, who could never be a made guy. And Henry, like a guy like Henry Hill, he wasn't taken in or provided with all the details of the planning and everything. Did maybe Vinny, if he had connections at the airport, did he maybe help them and help set that up, but just stayed way in the background? And Jimmy the Gent, Jimmy Burke, agreed that he would stay way in the background. Then he had ended up getting a piece of the action. Somebody got some of that money.
Well, here's what happened. Yeah, here's what happened. Jimmy Burke's crew got wind of the Lufthansa treasures, as it were, by accident. It was just by chance. But an inside man at Lufthansa was looking to make a score, and he talked to somebody who talked to somebody and got back to Burke. And that's what happened. Asaro supposedly was brought in, according to Henry Hill, his FBI debriefings, into the planning stages. Then Hill wasn't involved in anything, really. He wasn't involved in the heist. He wasn't involved in divvying up the money. He really wasn't involved in the mechanics. He wasn't a made guy. You know, he was a good associate, and as was Burke. So somebody like Asaro, if he was involved, was a critical component of this for the heist. Asaro may have been involved in the heist. He may not have been. You know, the evidence is what it is. But it was Asaro's connections.
Well,
to Joe Messino, other people, which may have helped divvy up the loot.
Yeah, you know how those mob guys are. As soon as they heard about all those millions of dollars, they were scrambling, figuring out a way to get their hands on it.
Well, that was what Burke was worried about. There was so much money out there and so many jewels. We got a lot of action here today. That they were worried about the crime families sort of wiping them out and trying to get their hands on it. And in fact, that didn't happen. So what they did was they paid off the family bosses. They paid off various top captains, gave them some money, gave them some jewels, so everybody was placated. So Burke and his people could sort of divvy up the loot any way they wanted to. And in Burke's case, most of it went to Burke, because a lot of the people involved in the heist, as you saw in the movie Goodfellas, did get killed.
Ended up
dead. Where did their share go? Oh, it went to Burke. They ended up dead, and the money went to Burke.
So was Henry Hill, I mean, I've watched some YouTube videos and some interviews with Henry Hill online, and he talks about the Lufthansa heist as if he was part of it. Are you saying that he was not?
He was not part of it.
He wasn't part of the crew.
No, Henry Hill was not present. He was not present. He was not present. He may have been involved in some of the planning stages, but he was not present. Because he was on work release in prison, and he really had to be careful. And some people didn't trust him. Some of the people, the inside people who were actually involved in the heist, did not trust Henry Hill. So he was right at the airport when this happened. There's that scene in the movie Goodfellas where he bangs on the shower wall and whoops it up.
Yeah.
When he heard about the heist,
yeah.
He was not present for it. He was not present.
He acted like he was going to get a piece of it, and if he didn't take part in it, he didn't get any part of it.
Yeah, you know, who knows what he got?
Yeah.
Who knows what he really got? He may have gotten some money from Burke, but Burke was very greedy. Burke was a very greedy guy.
Well,
and he kept a lot of that money for himself.
When they went into that to do that that job, I thought they weren't expecting to come away with that much money.
They weren't. They knew there was money, and they knew there were jewels, but they weren't sure of what they could really get in the end. And they were sort of mystified and surprised and stunned by what they got. There's a lot of jewels. You know, it's close to $1 million in jewels. There's over $5 million in cash. Some even say maybe six. But, you know, we'll settle at five. It's a lot of money for them. And these were sort of knuckleheads who hadn't seen that kind of money. Let's face it, a lot of people hadn't seen that kind of money. And they were rolling in dough.
really. It's like the dude that immediately went out and bought him a Cadillac. You know, that's the kind of thing your low rent mobster professional criminal that wants to get a lot of money, he's going to spend
it. That's eventually what happened. Asaro allegedly put some out on the street in terms of loan shark money. He supposedly bought a house with it. Other people stashed their money and gambled it away. Burke put it into the business, and they had done some dope deals. So, it got eaten up. There's none of that left anymore. It's all gone. Where the jewelry is, I don't know.
So I have
78. It didn't go out to like Vegas, so they could get it out of the city and then cut it up and sell it.
They supposedly cut it up here in New York, and they stash it in window and door frames. This is not guys who are going to put it in a brokerage account. They can't show that money in a concerted way. They have to hide it and spend it. And if they're careful, they'll spend it right. But some of these guys, they just blew it.
I noticed that there's like two different crime families seem to be involved. The Lucchese family, which they talked about in the movie, and then Asaro was with the Bonanno family. Is my thinking correct on that?
That's true.
So that's a little bit unusual.
Yeah,
you would have
the Bonanno family. No, if you think about it, traditionally you get a big score like this, and you get a lot of associates of different crime families involved. Everybody hears what's going down, so you got to appease the bosses of some of the other families. Colombo crime family supposedly got some money. Lucchese, of course, to Paul Vario. Joe Messina got some jewelry, and Gotti supposedly got some jewelry. John Gotti. So it was divvied up.
So as we said before, this Vinny Asaro,
it's not unusual.
At 80 years old, he's now, 30 years later or so, he's charged with this crime, and he goes to trial, and he gets found not guilty. Did you sit through the trial? Tony, did you sit through the trial?
I sat through a good part of it. I was there for some of the testimony and also the day he was acquitted.
So what do you think?
Asaro's cousin testified.
Normally, my experience with the feds, was this a federal case or a state case?
Yes, federal
case. It's been my, that's what I thought.
Federal
it's been,
racketeering.
My experience with these feds is they don't go to trial unless there is just no way that they can't win. They'll have everything lined up. Did they not quite have it lined up, or what's your opinion on how he got a not guilty?
I think they had, yeah, I'll answer that question. And simply, I think there were certain contradictions in the evidence. They were small, but they were, a juror could look at it and say, well, who's telling the truth? Everybody's dead. We only have this one government witness. They also, I think there was too much in the indictment. I think the case was somewhat confusing. But in the end, I don't think they believed the informant. So that's what happened.
Well, and these guys aren't above maybe paying a juror off. And if you actually did the Lufthansa heist and you had anything left, you'd probably have a few dollars to pay somebody.
he has nothing. He gambled it. He's an inveterate, compulsive gambler, and they blew it at the racetrack.
We had all that skim money coming into Kansas City back in the 70s and 80s, and those guys, I know that their descendants now, most of them are dead, but their descendants they've had to file bankruptcy. They've lost some of their original family homes in foreclosure. They just kind of get, one of them has a little business, they just kind of get by day to day. And I've had people ask me, what happens to that money? Well, they, like you say, they're gamblers. They do these different things. They take other risks and invest it in other people they think will go out and make them money, and then that guy will screw them over. There really is no honor among thieves, as they say.
They don't think ahead. They don't think strategically. They don't think about the future. It's all here and now. You know, and then it's gone. It's gone. Then they're crying the blues, you know, borrowing from Peter to pay Paul.
Really?
Well, for them.
That's the way it is. It's a sad life. It's a sad life.
It seems like to me, for them, they would, you know, they do a heist like this, and that's their life. So to the degree that they blow through the money, you would think they go, well, we're just going to do another heist. You know, cash is getting a little low. It's time to, you know, set up another job.
Yeah, you know, they're like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. They may have been able to do this early in their careers and get away with it, but eventually law enforcement gets caught up, gets more sophisticated. More people become informants, and they're not going to have that luxury of getting away with it or going to the next score. If they go to the next score, that's the one they may get caught in.
Do you think that the fact that it was, you know, JFK Airport and Lufthansa and the amount of money and the nature of the heist just made it that much more intense for them to get caught? You know, because obviously the compromising of the airport security.
Well, the airport security at the time was very dicey. The airport in the 60s and early 70s was a sieve. This crime occurred in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very intense investigation, but it only ensnared one guy back in 1978, the airport worker, this guy Lewis Werner. Everybody else escaped because either they were killed, or if they were killed, there was no evidence to give against Burke and the other kingpins. So they kind of like, you know, they got away with it because everybody was dying. And I don't think, you know, the government really had a handle on what to do.
Yeah. Well, they weren't dying
They got lucky with Werner. He got convicted.
But they weren't, other people weren't dying of natural causes.
Oh, no. They were getting killed. And, you know, the common wisdom is that it was Burke who was orchestrating it. And I think in large measure that's true. So whenever Burke sensed that something was getting close to him, I think the person who was most vulnerable was killed.
Henry Hill got lucky in that he didn't really go on that and wasn't really that close to it, or Burke would have killed him quick, because, you know, he was a weak sister. He was a drug addict and dabbling in narcotics,
yeah.
And they would have sensed that guy, if once they got him, he's going to turn in a second.
Yeah, that's the way it is. Henry was lucky in the sense that he got snared in the drug case, so they turned him into a federal witness pretty quickly, and he got taken out of commission, and hence he was protected. And Burke couldn't get to him, although they tried, but they couldn't get to him. So Henry, in a sense, got lucky.
Yeah.
He may not have had much of the Lufthansa heist money, but he got away with his life.
Yeah.
Where everybody else was dying or getting chased.
But I guess we'll start winding this down now. Tony, what about what's the condition? Everybody asks me, what's the condition of the mafia today, nationwide, from your perspective?
Well, I focus on the five families in New York, and they are a shell of what they once were. The leadership, the old leadership, is not there. It's either dead or in jail. And the guys who are coming up are really second and third rate players. Even fourth and fifth rate players. What you have is you have an influx of Italians from Italy, from Sicily and parts of Calabria. And they are the ones that law enforcement's a little concerned about, because law enforcement doesn't have informants within their structure. You know, gangs like the 'Ndrangheta, other branches of the Sicilian mafia.
Right, the Camorra. We just recorded the show.
Law enforcement doesn't have and, you know, there's a group called the United Sacred Crown. I don't know what the Italian is. But they are also not on law enforcement's radar. I would say that five families here are weakened in New York considerably, but we may be in a period of transition, so we're going to have to wait and see.
So they've got the five original kind of classic Italian mob families in New York. Is there, I mean, I would think that when it comes to law enforcement, that some of the other, I would say, more non-traditional crime elements that come in, maybe like M13 or the Crips and the Blood mm-hmm. type element is much more violent. And you think they're getting more focus?
Yes.
And maybe those guys are taking a piece of that action.
Well, MS-13 is getting more focus because it's so violent. The non-traditional, the Asians, the Russians, they come and go. They're not a factor as much anymore. The Albanians were a factor. They were very violent. But they sort of neutralized. The five families, like I said, are pretty much, you know, on their heels and have been for a long time. In fact, you know, the Colombo family is probably on life support. And they're probably not much of a family anyway. But, you know, the other gangs are getting attention. MS-13, because of all the bloody violence that they've wrought. So it's kind of, you know, law enforcement has a lot of things to do. Terrorism being the other major component, which is, you know, been getting the attention of the FBI, especially in New York.
You know, and another thing that appears to me is the modern-day Sicilian mafia in the United States and in all the major cities is they've lost their political connections. They used to have, I know in Kansas City, they had great political connections and they had two or three judges that they owned.
True.
It was the same way in Chicago, and I'm sure it's the same way in New York. I've paid more attention to Chicago, but they've lost all those political connections. Would you agree with that?
I do. You know, the big political connection for New York was Frank Costello in the 40s, early 50s. And when he left, when he died, when he got sort of raked over the coals in the Kefauver hearings, he was the last big political connection. And then, you know, the reform elements came in, and it became bad business to be associated with a mobster like that. So that political connection is no longer here. If there is a political connection, it's very, very low level. Nothing like they had with Frank Costello. There's a subject of a book I'm working on for hopefully next year.
I was just going to mention that to the people out there that it's my understanding my good friend Casey McBride is a huge, huge Frank Costello guy, and he's the one that got hold of me and said, ought to talk to you about your book, The Big Heist. And so he's all excited that there's going to be another book on Frank Costello. I'm looking forward to that, too. He was an interesting guy. He was the first real, like, kind of more sophisticated businessman that figured out it's better to make money than it is to go around and assert your male dominance over somebody else and fight with people all the time.
Exactly. That was the key to his life.
So when you're working on a book like this, like the...
The Big Heist.
I mean, do you have to go back and there must be some court records, there's some police records, anything that, I mean, when you're gathering evidence and source material for a book like this, there's not necessarily a lot of people that are going to come forward and talk to you, are there?
Well, for The Big Heist, I had the court testimony for Asaro. I had the court testimony and transcripts and evidence from the Warner case. I had old FBI reports, you know, people who worked the case. I was able to talk to. So, you know, and good newspaper clips. So, you know, you just got to mine the territory. You just got to get out there and do it.
Did you ever talk to anybody from Lufthansa?
Part of this job. No, I didn't talk to them, but I had their comments from the paper, you know, at the time. But they made their statements, so I used that. But really, the story wasn't so much Lufthansa as it was these characters, which is what everybody's... you know, interested in.
And I don't know if a JFK falls under the Port Authority or is it under a different structure for the airport?
Port Authority.
Anybody come forward and talk to you in the book for that?
No, actually I talked to some old Port Authority cops, you know, but then, by then, you know, whatever they had to say back then, you know, really wasn't important for this story, which is about the criminals. Let's face it, way back when the airport was open season for the mob.
Can you tell us anything about, so after this, then what changed? Did the airport change their security procedures? Did they obviously...
Oh, well, security changed. You have greater use of more extensive police operations. You have video cameras. You have greater access control. You have better screening of personnel. You have, you know, double and triple layer perimeters. Things have changed. Also, they're not, you know, you're not passing bearer bonds and stuff through the mail as much anymore. You know, the whole way we run our business, you know, doesn't require these things to move through commerce. I mean, I'm talking about paper.
Yeah, you don't have a something physical.
You know, you don't need that. You don't need that as much anymore. So that's changed. And, you know, security is better, let's face it. And the New York City Police Department, you know, has a much more robust presence at the airport along with the Port Authority Police. There's more cooperation.
Well, I would think certainly after 9/11 that would be the case.
Yeah. Well, of course. They work well together.
But even sometimes, you know, after the Lufthansa heist, you know, they must have gone back and done something to review what they were doing and doing wrong to try to tighten up the security.
I'm sure they did. But frankly, that wasn't part of the story I was trying to mine. It was about the wise guys.
Really? Well, you know, from the police standpoint, I know in the 70s and 80s, there was a significant change in most large cities started doing a joint task force with local police and the FBI and maybe even bring a DEA agent or an INS agent on and taking a look at these guys and doing like a full court press on somebody from every angle. Because like the FBI, I know when we get an FBI agent in Kansas City, he comes from Dallas, Texas, or he comes from El Paso or Denver. He walks to Kansas City, into Kansas City. He's like, he's like a brand new policeman, you know, never even carried a gun before.
Yeah.
And he shows up here in Kansas City. So then they would come to my unit, the intelligence unit, and those of us there had already spent at least 5 or 6 years on the streets. And we knew a lot of people, and we knew how to get around. And so then we would take those guys and work with them and kind of train them in a little way, in some ways, if you will, and continue to work in a task force manner, even though we didn't have a formal task force. But that started back then, and that helped a lot with the mob. Because you got the local guys will have, you know, family or friends or relatives that know these people. You know, their neighbors, or they'll know somebody that knows somebody, whereas your FBI agents, they don't know anybody when they first come in. So that made a huge difference,
too.
Yeah,
that's why there has to be good collaboration. There has to be good collaboration.
Yeah, it's been great to have you. It's a good show. I want to remind everybody, this is Anthony Tony DiStefano. And he wrote the book, the definitive book on the Lufthansa case, The Big Heist. It was just released. You can get it, I'm sure, at all the usual outlets, Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all that. Do you have a website, Tony, that somebody could order one and get an autographed copy from you directly? What is that website?
Well, it's www.tonydistefano.com. Listen, gentlemen, thank you. It's been fun.
All right.
Like I said, I wish I had more time, but I got to get to an assignment.
This was great. Thanks,
so,
Tony.
Maybe we'll talk again.
Okay.
When your next book comes out.
Yeah, the Frank Costello book comes out, we'll watch for that, and we'll get hold of you then.
We'll be in touch.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
A guy who's, you know, been working a beat for quite some time.
Yeah, he knows that New York mob.
How many books does he have? I'm looking here. We've got... two additional books, Mob Killer, The Bloody Rampage of Charles Carneglia, Mafia Hitman, which was from June of 2011, Vinnie Gorgeous, The Ugly Rise and Fall of a New York Mobster in July of 2013, and then he has coverage of a human trafficking inspired another book, The War on Human Trafficking, although it doesn't show the date of that.
Looks like he wrote another book, Gangland New York, which was, I'm not sure why that's like an addition, but Gangland New York by Anthony DiStefano was published in 2015, so you might want to look for that. That looks interesting. And this one is The Big Heist. He's an interesting guy. He's been there right on the cutting edge during all the 70s and 80s and watched the five families, as he said, fall, basically, just like in Kansas City. He said the Colombo family was on the life support system, and and the rest of them aren't doing so well.
I'm sure they wouldn't like to hear that, though.
Well,
they probably don't think they're on life support.
I'll bet they do. I'll bet they do.
Somebody in the world probably wants to have a DNR.
DNR.
Do not resuscitate.
Oh. I always think that's a dialed number recorder.
Is that a police term?
That was a police term, yeah, for a pin register. You put a machine on your phone, and it would record every number you dialed. You didn't have to have a full warrant for that.
And it was called a?
Dialed number recorder, a DNR machine.
A DNR machine. Interesting. Now, is this true? Is this the Happy Lance Social Club Fire? Is that another book that he wrote? There's a couple here I'm reading. Reputed Gambino crime boss Peter Gotti, former Bonanno crime boss Joseph Massino, and the so-called Mafia Cop in 2006.
Those are articles that he did.
Oh, those are articles.
Articles he wrote for Newsday, New York City.
Which is the paper that he works for.
Yeah, he's part of the staff there, and he's written articles about Bernard Goetz. He covered that case. You know, he also, as Vinny Acero, he went to this trial too. We talked about it just a little bit. He just got popped. He was probably arrested a while back, but they just stood trial with John J. Gotti. We did a story on John J. Gotti's, was he the grandson of the original John Gotti? He's some connection to the original John Gotti, and he took a hit for dealing in steroids and other narcotics, and he and this Vinny Acero that Tony was talking about just went to trial this week, third week of June, I believe it is, on a road rage case of all things. This is how low rent these guys have gotten in New York City. Of course, John Gotti, he had one of his neighbors killed because the guy accidentally killed his kid. But this was a road rage where somebody cut off Vinny Acero in traffic. And I can't remember the guy's name, but Vinny Acero figured probably got his license plate, and those kind of guys always got a way to get a license number checked. And so he hired this John Gotti, or got John Gotti as a favor to help him, and they burnt the guy's car. They torched his car, and they're standing trial right now for arson of this guy's car. So that's the state of the mob bosses in New York City. Is they're burning people's cars because they're mad at them over a road rage incident. I have a hard time giving these guys a whole lot of credit myself, Aaron. I know a lot of people like to make them into bigger-than-life characters, and in some ways I guess they were at one time, but when you really get to know a lot about them, they're not bigger-than-life characters. We had a message from Jonas Apert. He's from Sweden. He's one of our listeners from Sweden. He loves Gangland Wire, and he requests a story on Paul Rica, known as the Waiter, and he's from the Chicago outfit. So actually, he's a guy that Red Womette knows quite a little bit about. We might tap him to do a show on Paul the Waiter, and I'll do a bunch of research on Paul the Waiter. I know there's quite a little bit of information out there about him.
All these mob guys, you know, a lot of times they had to have some sort of a legitimate job. Didn't they? I mean,
some of them did. They mainly had we talked about that before. A lot of them had little businesses of some kind that it make it look like they had some income from.
Something they could launder some of that money through.
Exactly.
I mean, if you're a waiter, you know how that is. Every cash tip
yeah, there you go.
Goes right in your pocket.
Maybe that's how you got the, that's how I see where you're headed now. And they could use you. You could be a mob guy and you could show that you're making $100,000 a year in tips. See, all you really have to show on paper is about how much you spend to live. So if you make a car payment of $300 a month and you've got a house payment of $1,000 a month, and you know, just figure your normal groceries and gas and all that, then you know, adds up to say $25,000 a year, then you just have to show on paper that's about how much money you make.
Yeah.
That's how they get these guys.
And I don't have a car. I live in an apartment. So no one's going to make a lot of money at about $18,000 a year off of me, skimming it.
They're going to have a hell of a time laundering any money through you. You're going to be in trouble quick. They're going to say, well, wait a minute. here this guy makes about eight, you know, he works at a place where he normally would make about $18,000 a year, but he shows he made $100,000 last year. What's up with that? We better look at him.
It was a good year.
It was a hell of a good year at Chubby's, man. He must have had Mike Tyson in there and his whole entourage after the strip club closed every night, huh?
You know, I've had a few celebrities in there and I've waited on them. And, you know, sometimes, you know, like Tech N9ne, he's kind of famous for Kansas City. He's a rapper.
Yeah.
You know, he was there with another guy and some gals, and I don't know if they spent $30, $40 maybe, and he tipped $20.
Oh, that's good. That's
great. Which is, you know, that's a good percentage.
Yeah, that is.
You know, as that goes, but that's like everybody else, just Joe on the street percentage.
Really?
That's not celebrity, you know, multi-million dollar deal offer, you know, tip. Yeah. Justin Bieber performed at the Sprint Center, and the opening act was Post Malone.
Yeah.
It's a guy, rapper, white guy out of like Dallas who got famous on SoundCloud. He came in with some of his guys.
His troop, his posse.
His posse. And they ordered, I don't know, it was $150 maybe worth of food to take with them, get on their bus to go to the next gig. And a $200 tip.
Oh, wow. Great.
Of course, it went, because it was like at the end of the shift, I was trying to get out of there. And so I put it under the manager's. You know, I logged in as the manager, and I put the order in under the manager, not knowing what kind of tip it was going to be. And, of course, $200 later, there's the manager going, well, we're going to go ahead and give, you know, $60 to the cook and, you know, and $60 to this guy, and you're going to get $60. And all I can think is, on a, you know, one of the cooks wanted to leave. He didn't even want to stay and cook the food. One of the guys who was coming on stepped in and helped out. So that guy didn't deserve any of that. And then really? I'm the only guy making half a minimum wage here.
You mean none of those mob guys that used to go in there didn't give you a big tip all the time? What kind of tippers were those mob guys?
I mean, they were good tippers, but they would just get like a sandwich and a, you know, and a coffee, you know. And so Chubby's is not a high dollar restaurant. So you're talking about, you know, like a $10, $12 meal. And maybe they'd give you $5.
Well, that's a pretty good tip. That's almost 50% for a $10 meal. That's pretty good. Well, good. I'm glad they did that. I'm glad they did that.
As long as I kept my mouth shut.
Now you're talking about them. They're going to come want their money back, Aaron. Oh, they're in jail.
Some of them are in jail.
Some of them are. None of them listen to our podcast, more than likely.
I always encourage Uncle Frank to, and I was going to tell him about, you know, the Frank Culotta episode. I thought that would be one he might be interested in. But, you know, I brought this up to him a long time ago, before the article came out about his uncle.
Uncle Sam Palma.
Yeah, you know. And usually he kind of diverted the conversation. And after two or three times of kind of bringing it up, going, oh, you should check this out. Oh, we just talked about this. Oh, we just talked about that. I stopped bringing it up.
Yeah.
I don't think he really wanted to hear any of it.
Probably if you had lived a life and your relatives have lived a life, it's not that interesting or entertaining.
Yeah, let alone to have a retired cop talk about it. Well. With me, and I'm not even, you know, I just I'm Aaron the waiter.
Aaron the waiter. Aaron the waiter Gnert.
Aaron the knife.
Aaron the blade.
The blade. Remember
the blade. That's your nickname. That's your moniker.
My moniker is the blade.
The blade.
I'll cut you with my words. Speaking of cutting you with your words, what about your public service announcement?
Well, it's a good time to do that, Aaron. Thanks for reminding me. If you have a friend or relative who has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks need to go out and buy the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available on Amazon for like $7. You can rent it, but why rent it when you can own it? And then you want to go out and download the Kansas City Mob Tour app so you can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City, and then get the book that Gary just released, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
You can get the printed copy, but when you get the printed copy, you also want to get the Kindle, because the Kindle has links to files where you can actually listen to the mob guys talk about the crimes that they were committing with a transcript, because sometimes they're using codes, they're talking in Sicilian, and you're not always sure what it is that they were actually saying, because it's a wiretap recording. But Gary took the time and effort to transcribe all of that and put it together in written copy as a book, and on a Kindle where you can actually hear these guys talk about the crimes they were committing.
Yeah, cool. It was all you do is click on a link, and it takes you right to a Vimeo site that has each of those wiretaps linked to it. You can just listen to the real guys talk about it.
And then remember to put a hit out on our donate button.
You can be a soldado, a capo, a
capo de tutti.
Capo de tutti de capi for enough money. A Don. We've got a guy, Don, we'll do a podcast with you or have you on the podcast. We've got one that we're maybe going to record later today. I'm not sure if we get the guy to call in. We've got a couple, three Dons out there that
we just got a new Don. He's our Don for Milwaukee.
Milwaukee, yeah. We've got one in Blue Springs. We've got one in Milwaukee. We've got a Capo de Tutti de Capi in Smithville.
Didn't we have a soldado in England?
We got a soldado in England, yes, in Scotland, actually. We did that show at his request, John Drummond from Scotland. So we'll get that one out on the Camorra Mob. You know, our friend Tony DeStefano just talked about the Camorra Mob and the Drangheta families and how they're moving in to where the Sicilian Mafia is reducing in size and losing out in power. And these new mobs from Italy are moving into the United States. Well, ever-changing, ongoing source of stories and excitement for us. Next thing, and then movies and TV shows and all that kind of stuff.
And remember to give us a like, give us a share, give us a follow, subscribe on the iTunes account. And when the episode is released, you will get a notice and it pretty much goes right to you there. And give us a review. We've got like 5 stars, I think it is, on the iTunes.
I think we got 36 5 stars and 1 4-star, I believe. So we need more.
And we need some reviews.
Yeah, the more we get, the higher up we go in as they allow people to find our podcast. It'll be easier to find the more reviews we've got. All right, say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, everybody.
Bumper music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.
On the advice of my lawyer, I respectfully refuse to answer that question, as my truthful answer may tend to incriminate me.